Both loans are to be repaid within a year. The year passes. The Dutch merchant sells the land he's bought at a handsome markup and repays your money with the interest he promised. Your father is pleased. But your little brother in Madrid is getting nervous. The war with France ended well for the King of Spain, but he has now embroiled himself in a conflict with the Turks. He needs every penny to finance the new war and thinks this is far more important than repaying old debts. Your brother sends letters to the palace and asks friends with connections at court to intercede, but to no avail. Not only has your brother not earned the promised interest, he's lost the principal. Your father is not pleased. Now, to make matters worse, the king sends a treasury official to your brother to tell him, in no uncertain terms, that he expects to receive another loan of the same size forthwith. Your brother has no money to lend. He writes home to Dad, trying to persuade him that this time the king will come through. The paterfamilias has a soft spot for his youngest and agrees with a heavy heart. Another 10,000 gold coins disappear into the Spanish treasury, never to be seen again. Meanwhile, in Amsterdam, things are looking bright. You make more and more loans to enterprising Dutch merchants who repay them promptly and in full. But your luck does not hold indefinitely. One of your usual clients has a hunch that wooden clogs are going to be the next fashion craze in Paris and asks you for a loan to set up a footwear emporium in the French capital. You lend him the money, but unfortunately the clogs don't catch on with the French ladies and the disgruntled merchant refuses to repay the loan. Your father is furious and tells both of you it is time to unleash the lawyers. Your brother files suit in Madrid against the Spanish monarch, while you file suit in Amsterdam against the erstwhile wooden shoe wizard. In Spain, the law courts are subservient to the king. The judges serve at his pleasure and fear punishment if they do not do his will. In the Netherlands, the courts are a separate branch of government, not dependent on the country's burghers and princes. The court in Madrid throws out your brother's suit, while the court in Amsterdam fines in your favour and puts a lien on the clog merchant's assets to force him to pay up. Your father has learned his lesson. Better to do business with merchants than with kings, and better to do it in Holland than in Madrid. And your brother's travails are not over. The King of Spain desperately needs more money to pay his army. He's sure that your father has cash to spare. So he brings trumped-up treason charges against your brother. If he doesn't come up with 20,000 gold coins forthwith, he'll get cast into a dungeon and rot there until he dies. Your father has had enough. He pays the ransom for his beloved son, but swears never to do business in Spain again. He closes his Madrid branch and relocates your brother to Rotterdam. Two branches in Holland now look like a really good idea. He hears that even Spanish capitalists are smuggling their fortunes out of their country. They too realize that if they want to keep their money and use it to gain more wealth, they are better off investing it where the rule of law prevails and where private property is respected. In the Netherlands, for example. In such ways did the King of Spain squander the trust of investors at the same time that Dutch merchants gained their confidence. And it was the Dutch merchants, not the Dutch state, who built the Dutch Empire. The King of Spain kept on trying to finance and maintain his conquests by raising unpopular taxes from a disgruntled populace. The Dutch merchants financed conquest by getting loans, and increasingly also by selling shares in their companies that entitled their holders to receive a portion of the company's profits. Cautious investors who would never have given their money to the King of Spain, and who would have thought twice before extending credit to the Dutch government, happily invested fortunes in the Dutch joint stock companies that were the mainstay of the new empire. If you thought a company was going to make a big profit but it had already sold all its shares, you could buy some from people who owned them, probably for a higher price than they originally paid. If you bought shares and later discovered that the company was in dire straits, you could try to unload your stock for a lower price. The resulting trade in company shares led to the establishment in most major European cities of stock exchanges, places where the shares of companies were traded. The most famous Dutch joint stock company, the Vereenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, or VOC for short, was chartered in 1602 just as the Dutch were throwing off Spanish rule and the boom of Spanish artillery could still be heard not far from Amsterdam's ramparts. VOC used the money it raised from selling shares to build ships, send them to Asia, and bring back Chinese, Indian, and Indonesian goods. It also financed military actions taken by company ships against competitors and pirates. Eventually, VOC money financed the conquest of Indonesia. Indonesia is the world's biggest archipelago. Its thousands upon thousands of islands were ruled in the early 17th century by hundreds of kingdoms, principalities, sultanates, and tribes. When VOC merchants first arrived in Indonesia in 1603, their aims were strictly commercial. However, in order to secure their commercial interests and maximize the profits of the shareholders, VOC merchants began to fight against local potentates who charged inflated tariffs, as well as against European competitors. VOC armed its merchant ships with cannons. It recruited European, Japanese, Indian, and Indonesian mercenaries, and it built forts and conducted full-scale battles and sieges. This enterprise may sound a little strange to us, but in the early modern age it was common for private companies to hire not only soldiers, but also generals and admirals, cannons and ships, and even entire off-the-shelf armies. The international community took this for granted and didn't raise an eyebrow when a private company established an empire. Island after island fell to VOC mercenaries, and a large part of Indonesia became a VOC colony. VOC ruled Indonesia for close to 200 years. Only in 1800 did the Dutch state assume control of Indonesia, making it a Dutch national colony for the following 150 years. Today, some people warn that 21st century corporations are accumulating too much power. Early modern history shows just how far that can go if businesses are allowed to pursue their self-interest unchecked. While VOC operated in the Indian Ocean, the Dutch West Indies Company, or WIC, plied the Atlantic. In order to control trade on the important Hudson River, WIC built a settlement called New Amsterdam on an island at the river's mouth. The colony was threatened by Indians and repeatedly attacked by the British, who eventually captured it in 1664. The British changed its name to New York. The remains of the wall built by WIC to defend its colony against Indians and British are today paved over by the world's most famous street, Wall Street. As the 17th century wound to an end, complacency and costly continental wars caused the Dutch to lose not only New York, but also their place as Europe's financial and imperial engine. The vacancy was hotly contested by France and Britain. At first, France seemed to be in a far stronger position. It was bigger than Britain, richer, more populous, and it possessed a larger and more experienced army. Yet Britain managed to win the trust of the financial system, whereas France proved itself unworthy. The behavior of the French crown was particularly notorious during what was called the Mississippi Bubble, the largest financial crisis of 18th century Europe. That story also begins with an empire-building joint stock company. In 1717, the Mississippi Company, chartered in France, set out to colonize the lower Mississippi Valley, establishing the city of New Orleans in the process. To finance its ambitious plans, the company, which had good connections at the court of King Louis XV, sold shares on the Paris Stock Exchange. John Law, the company's director, was also the governor of the Central Bank of France. Furthermore, the king had appointed him Controller General of Finances, an office roughly equivalent to that of a modern finance minister. In 1717, the lower Mississippi Valley offered few attractions besides swamps and alligators, yet the Mississippi Company spread tales of fabulous riches and boundless opportunities. French aristocrats, businessmen, and the stolid members of the urban bourgeoisie fell for these fantasies, and Mississippi share prices skyrocketed. Initially, shares were offered at 500 livres apiece. On 1 August 1719, shares traded at 2,750 livres. By 30 August, they were worth 4,100 livres, and on 4 September, they reached 5,000 livres. On 2 December, the price of a Mississippi share crossed the threshold of 10,000 livres. Euphoria swept the streets of Paris. People sold all their possessions and took huge loans in order to buy Mississippi shares. Everybody believed they'd discovered the easy way to riches. A few days later, the panic began. Some speculators realized that the share prices were totally unrealistic and unsustainable. They figured that they had better sell while stock prices were at their peak. As the supply of shares available rose, their price declined. When other investors saw the price going down, they also wanted to get out quick. The stock price plummeted further, setting off an avalanche. In order to stabilize prices, the Central Bank of France, at the direction of its governor, John Law, bought up Mississippi shares, but it could not do so forever. Eventually, it ran out of money. When this happened, the Controller General of Finances, the same John Law, authorized the printing of more money in order to buy additional shares. This placed the entire French financial system inside the bubble. And not even this financial wizardry could save the day. The price of Mississippi shares dropped from 10,000 livres back to 1,000 livres, and then collapsed completely, and the shares lost every sou of their worth. By now, the Central Bank and the Royal Treasury owned a huge amount of worthless stock and had no money. The big speculators emerged largely unscathed. They had sold in time. Small investors lost everything, and many committed suicide. The Mississippi bubble was one of history's most spectacular financial crashes. The Royal French financial system never recuperated fully from the blow. The way in which the Mississippi Company used its political clout to manipulate share prices and fuel the buying frenzy caused the public to lose faith in the French banking system and in the financial wisdom of the French king. Louis XV found it more and more difficult to raise credit. This became one of the chief reasons that the overseas French empire fell into British hands. While the British could borrow money easily and at low interest rates, France had difficulties securing loans and had to pay high interest on them. In order to finance his growing debts, the King of France borrowed more and more money at higher and higher interest rates. Eventually, in the 1780s, Louis XVI, who had ascended to the throne on his grandfather's death, realized that half his annual budget was tied to servicing the interest on his loans, and that he was heading towards bankruptcy. Reluctantly, in 1789, Louis XVI convened the Estates General, the French Parliament that had not met for a century and a half, in order to find a solution to the crisis. Thus began the French Revolution. While the French overseas empire was crumbling, the British Empire was expanding rapidly. Like the Dutch Empire before it, the British Empire was established and run largely by private joint stock companies based in the London Stock Exchange. The first English settlements in North America were established in the early 17th century by joint stock companies such as the London Company, the Plymouth Company, the Dorchester Company, and the Massachusetts Company. The Indian subcontinent, too, was conquered not by the British state, but by the mercenary army of the British East India Company. This company outperformed even the VOC. From its headquarters in Leadenhall Street, London, it ruled a mighty Indian empire for about a century, maintaining a huge military force of up to 350,000 soldiers, considerably outnumbering the armed forces of the British monarchy. Only in 1858 did the British Crown nationalize India, along with the company's private army. Napoleon made fun of the British, calling them a nation of shopkeepers. Yet these shopkeepers defeated Napoleon himself, and their empire was the largest the world has ever seen. In the name of capital. The nationalization of Indonesia by the Dutch Crown, 1800, and of India by the British Crown, 1858, hardly ended the embrace of capitalism and empire. On the contrary, the connection only grew stronger during the 19th century. Joint stock companies no longer needed to establish and govern private colonies. Their managers and large shareholders now pulled the strings of power in London, Amsterdam, and Paris, and they could count on the state to look after their interests. As Marx and other social critics quipped, Western governments were becoming a capitalist trade union. The most notorious example of how governments did the bidding of big money was the First Opium War, fought between Britain and China, 1840 to 42. In the first half of the 19th century, the British East India Company and sundry British business people made fortunes by exporting drugs, particularly opium, to China. Millions of Chinese became addicts, debilitating the country both economically and socially. In the late 1830s, the Chinese government issued a ban on drug trafficking, but British drug merchants simply ignored the law. Chinese authorities began to confiscate and destroy drug cargoes. The drug cartels had close connections in Westminster and Downing Street. Many MPs and cabinet ministers, in fact, held stock in the drug companies, so they pressured the government to take action. In 1840, Britain duly declared war on China in the name of free trade. It was a walkover. The overconfident Chinese were no match for Britain's new wonder weapons: steamboats, heavy artillery, rockets, and rapid-fire rifles. Under the subsequent peace treaty, China agreed not to constrain the activities of British drug merchants and to compensate them for damages inflicted by the Chinese police. Furthermore, the British demanded and received control of Hong Kong, which they proceeded to use as a secure base for drug trafficking. Hong Kong remained in British hands until 1997. In the late 19th century, about 40 million Chinese, a tenth of the country's population, were opium addicts. Egypt, too, learned to respect the long arm of British capitalism. During the 19th century, French and British investors lent huge sums to the rulers of Egypt, first in order to finance the Suez Canal project, and later to fund far less successful enterprises. Egyptian debt swelled, and European creditors increasingly meddled in Egyptian affairs. In 1881, Egyptian nationalists had had enough and rebelled. They declared a unilateral abrogation of all foreign debt. Queen Victoria was not amused. A year later, she dispatched her army and navy to the Nile, and Egypt remained a British protectorate until after World War II. These were hardly the only wars fought in the interests of investors. In fact, war itself could become a commodity, just like opium. In 1821, the Greeks rebelled against the Ottoman Empire. The uprising aroused great sympathy in liberal and romantic circles in Britain. Lord Byron, the poet, even went to Greece to fight alongside the insurgents. But London financiers saw an opportunity as well. They proposed to the rebel leaders the issue of tradable Greek rebellion bonds on the London Stock Exchange. The Greeks would promise to repay the bonds, plus interest, if and when they won their independence. Private investors bought bonds to make a profit, or out of sympathy for the Greek cause, or both. The value of Greek rebellion bonds rose and fell on the London Stock Exchange in tempo with military successes and failures on the battlefields of Hellas. The Turks gradually gained the upper hand. With a rebel defeat imminent, the bondholders faced the prospect of losing their trousers. The bondholders' interest was the national interest, so the British organized an international fleet that, in 1827, sank the main Ottoman flotilla in the Battle of Navarino. After centuries of subjugation, Greece was finally free. But freedom came with a huge debt that the new country had no way of repaying. The Greek economy was mortgaged to British creditors for decades to come. The bear hug between capital and politics has had far-reaching implications for the credit market. The amount of credit in an economy is determined not only by purely economic factors, such as the discovery of a new oil field or the invention of a new machine, but also by political events, such as regime changes or more ambitious foreign policies. After the Battle of Navarino, British capitalists were more willing to invest their money in risky overseas deals. They had seen that if a foreign debtor refused to repay loans, Her Majesty's Army would get their money back. This is why today a country's credit rating is far more important to its economic well-being than are its natural resources. Credit ratings indicate the probability that a country will pay its debts. In addition to purely economic data, they take into account political, social, and even cultural factors. An oil-rich company, cursed with a despotic government, endemic warfare, and a corrupt judicial system, will usually receive a low credit rating. As a result, it is likely to remain relatively poor, since it will not be able to raise the necessary capital to make the most of its oil bounty. A country devoid of natural resources, but which enjoys peace, a fair judicial system, and a free government, is likely to receive a high credit rating. As such, it may be able to raise enough cheap capital to support a good education system and foster a flourishing high-tech industry. The cult of the free market. Capital and politics influence each other to such an extent that their relations are hotly debated by economists, politicians, and the general public alike. Ardent capitalists tend to argue that capital should be free to influence politics, but politics should not be allowed to influence capital. They argue that when governments interfere in the markets, political interests cause them to make unwise investments that result in slower growth. For example, a government may impose heavy taxation on industrialists and use the money to give lavish unemployment benefits, which are popular with voters. In the view of many business people, it would be far better if the government left the money with them. They would use it, they claim, to open new factories and hire the unemployed. In this view, the wisest economic policy is to keep politics out of the economy, reduce taxation and government regulation to a minimum, and allow market forces free rein to take their course. Private investors, unencumbered by political considerations, will invest their money where they can get the most profit. So the way to ensure the most economic growth, which will benefit everyone, industrialists and workers, is for the government to do as little as possible. This free market doctrine is today the most common and influential variant of the capitalist creed. The most enthusiastic advocates of the free market criticize military adventures abroad with as much zeal as welfare programs at home. They offer governments the same advice that Zen masters offer initiates: just do nothing. But in its extreme form, belief in the free market is as naive as belief in Santa Claus. There simply is no such thing as a market free of all political bias. The most important economic resource is trust in the future, and this resource is constantly threatened by thieves and charlatans. Markets by themselves offer no protection against fraud, theft, and violence. It is the job of political systems to ensure trust by legislating sanctions against cheats and to establish and support police forces, courts, and jails which will enforce the law. When kings fail to do their jobs and regulate the markets properly, it leads to loss of trust, dwindling credit, and economic depression. That was the lesson taught by the Mississippi Bubble of 1719, and anyone who forgot it was reminded by the U.S. housing bubble of 2007 and the ensuing credit crunch and recession. The capitalist hell. There is an even more fundamental reason why it's dangerous to give markets a completely free rein. Adam Smith taught that the shoemaker would use his surplus to employ more assistants. This implies that egoistic greed is beneficial for all, since profits are utilized to expand production and hire more employees. Yet what happens if the greedy shoemaker increases his profits by paying employees less and increasing their work hours? The standard answer is that the free market would protect the employees. If our shoemaker pays too little and demands too much, the best employees would naturally abandon him and go to work for his competitors. The tyrant shoemaker would find himself left with the worst laborers or with no laborers at all. He would have to mend his ways or go out of business. His own greed would compel him to treat his employees well. This sounds bulletproof in theory, but in practice, the bullets get through all too easily. In a completely free market, unsupervised by kings and priests, avaricious capitalists can establish monopolies or collude against their workforces. If there is a single corporation controlling all shoe factories in a country, or if all factory owners conspire to reduce wages simultaneously, then the laborers are no longer able to protect themselves by switching jobs. Even worse, greedy bosses might curtail the workers' freedom of movement through debt peonage or slavery. At the end of the Middle Ages, slavery was almost unknown in Christian Europe. During the early modern period, the rise of European capitalism went hand in hand with the rise of the Atlantic slave trade. unrestrained market forces rather than tyrannical kings or racist ideologues were responsible for this calamity. When the Europeans conquered America, they opened gold and silver mines and established sugar, tobacco, and cotton plantations. These mines and plantations became the mainstay of American production and export. The sugar plantations were particularly important. In the Middle Ages, sugar was a rare luxury in Europe. It was imported from the Middle East at prohibitive prices and used sparingly as a secret ingredient in delicacies and snake oil medicines. After large sugar plantations were established in America, ever-increasing amounts of sugar began to reach Europe. The price of sugar dropped, and Europe developed an insatiable sweet tooth. Entrepreneurs met this need by producing huge quantities of sweets, cakes, cookies, chocolate, candy, and sweetened beverages such as cocoa, coffee, and tea. The annual sugar intake of the average Englishman rose from near zero in the early 17th century to around 18 pounds in the early 19th century. However, growing cane and extracting its sugar was a labor-intensive business. Few people wanted to work long hours in malaria-infested sugar fields under a tropical sun. Contract laborers would have produced a commodity too expensive for mass consumption. Sensitive to market forces and greedy for profits and economic growth, European plantation owners switched to slaves. From the 16th to the 19th centuries, about 10 million African slaves were imported to America. About 70% of them worked on the sugar plantations. Labor conditions were abominable. Most slaves lived a short and miserable life, and millions more died during wars waged to capture slaves or during the long voyage from inner Africa to the shores of America. All this so that Europeans could enjoy their sweet tea and candy, and sugar barons could enjoy huge profits. The slave trade was not controlled by any state or government. It was a purely economic enterprise, organized and financed by the free market according to the laws of supply and demand. Private slave trading companies sold shares on the Amsterdam, London, and Paris stock exchanges. Middle-class Europeans looking for a good investment bought these shares. Relying on this money, the companies bought ships, hired sailors and soldiers, purchased slaves in Africa, and transported them to America. There they sold the slaves to the plantation owners, using the proceeds to purchase plantation products such as sugar, cocoa, coffee, tobacco, cotton, and rum. They returned to Europe, sold the sugar and cotton for a good price, and then sailed to Africa to begin another round. The shareholders were very pleased with this arrangement. Throughout the 18th century, the yield on slave trade investments was about 6% a year. They were extremely profitable, as any modern consultant would be quick to admit. This is the fly in the ointment of free market capitalism. It cannot ensure that profits are gained in a fair way or distributed in a fair manner. On the contrary, the craving to increase profits and production blinds people to anything that might stand in the way. When growth becomes a supreme good, unrestricted by any other ethical considerations, it can easily lead to catastrophe. Some religions, such as Christianity and Nazism, have killed millions out of burning hatred. Capitalism has killed millions out of cold indifference coupled with greed. The Atlantic slave trade did not stem from racist hatred towards Africans. The individuals who bought the shares, the brokers who sold them, and the managers of the slave trade companies rarely thought about the Africans, nor did the owners of the sugar plantations. Many owners lived far from their plantations, and the only information they demanded were neat ledgers of profits and losses. It is important to remember that the Atlantic slave trade was not a single aberration in an otherwise spotless record. The Great Bengal Famine, discussed in the previous chapter, was caused by a similar dynamic. The British East India Company cared more about its profits than about the lives of 10 million Bengalis. VOC's military campaigns in Indonesia were financed by upstanding Dutch burghers who loved their children, gave to charity and enjoyed good music and fine art, but had no regard for the suffering of the inhabitants of Java, Sumatra, and Malacca. Countless other crimes and misdemeanors accompanied the growth of the modern economy in other parts of the planet. The 19th century brought no improvement in the ethics of capitalism. The Industrial Revolution that swept through Europe enriched the bankers and capital owners, but condemned millions of workers to a life of abject poverty. In the European colonies, things were even worse. In 1876, King Leopold II of Belgium set up a non-governmental humanitarian organization with the declared aim of exploring Central Africa and fighting the slave trade along the Congo River. It was also charged with improving conditions for the inhabitants of the region by building roads, schools, and hospitals. In 1885, the European powers agreed to give this organization control of 1.4 million square miles in the Congo Basin. This territory, 75 times the size of Belgium, was henceforth known as the Congo Free State. Nobody asked the opinion of the territory's 20 to 30 million inhabitants. Within a short time, the humanitarian organization became a business enterprise whose real aim was growth and profit. The schools and hospitals were forgotten, and the Congo Basin was instead filled with mines and plantations, run by mostly Belgian officials who ruthlessly exploited the local population. The rubber industry was particularly notorious. Rubber was fast becoming an industrial staple, and rubber export was the Congo's most important source of income. The African villagers who collected the rubber were required to provide higher and higher quotas. Those who failed to deliver their quota were punished brutally for their laziness. Their arms were chopped off, and occasionally entire villages were massacred. According to the most moderate estimates, between 1885 and 1908, the pursuit of growth and profits cost the lives of 6 million individuals, at least 20% of the Congo's population. Some estimates reach up to 10 million deaths. After 1908, and especially after 1945, capitalist greed was somewhat reined in, not least due to the fear of communism. Yet inequities are still rampant. The economic pie of 2014 is far larger than the pie of 1500, but it is distributed so unevenly that many African peasants and Indonesian laborers return home after a hard day's work with less food than did their ancestors 500 years ago. Much like the agricultural revolution, so too the growth of the modern economy might turn out to be a colossal fraud. The human species and the global economy may well keep growing, but many more individuals may live in hunger and want. Capitalism has two answers to this criticism. First, capitalism has created a world that nobody but a capitalist is capable of running. The only serious attempt to manage the world differently, communism, was so much worse in almost every conceivable way that nobody has the stomach to try again. In 8500 BC, one could cry bitter tears over the agricultural revolution, but it was too late to give up agriculture. Similarly, we may not like capitalism, but we cannot live without it. The second answer is that we just need more patience. Paradise, the capitalists promise, is right around the corner. True, mistakes have been made, such as the Atlantic slave trade and the exploitation of the European working class, but we have learned our lesson, and if we just wait a little longer and allow the pie to grow a little bigger, everybody will receive a fatter slice. The division of spoils will never be equitable, but there will be enough to satisfy every man, woman, and child, even in the Congo. There are, indeed, some positive signs. At least when we use purely material criteria, such as life expectancy, child mortality, and calorie intake, the standard of living of the average human in 2014 is significantly higher than it was in 1914, despite the exponential growth in the number of humans. Yet, can the economic pie grow indefinitely? Every pie requires raw materials and energy. Prophets of doom warn that sooner or later Homo sapiens will exhaust the raw materials and energy of planet Earth. And what will happen then?